From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
I'm David Tulitz.
David, good to have you back.
Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. Lots of stuff going on. Lots of cool stuff, different stuff going on. So let's get right into it. But first, tell us, if you would, about our guest.
We have a special guest, Mark Palm from Samaritan Aviation, and he operates out of Papua New Guinea. That's near Australia.
Awesome.
And he does a missionary-based humanitarian rescue work with some Cessna float planes. And he's a cool guy. He's going to tell us how he got involved in that and what other pilots can do if they want to follow his footsteps. We have with us today on Hangar Talk, we have Mark Palm from Samaritan Aviation. And Mark, you are doing a lot of outreach in New Guinea. Tell us a little bit about what the latest is for you guys in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, David, good morning. It's great to be with you. I, you know, it was great talking to you a few years ago, and it's exciting to be giving you an update. We're actually bringing a new airplane over this summer. But in Papua New Guinea, most people don't realize, but Papua New Guinea is the second largest island in the world. And in the area that we work in, there's 600,000 people in one hospital. So we're going into this 700-mile river. We operate seaplanes, amphibious, that's the 206s. So we're operating in this very remote area where most of the people are 3 to 5 days away from the one hospital that's there. And so we're providing access and hope to all of these people that live along this large river. And so it's exciting. Since I spoke with you last, we've added three additional pilots. We're bringing over, as I mentioned, a new airplane this in August of this year. And we're just excited at the ability that we've had to continue our work. You know, we're on call 7 days a week as an air ambulance for emergency life flights. We do medicine delivery to over 40 different aid posts along the river, and also disaster relief. Responding to flooding issues. We even responded to a volcano that erupted here a couple of months ago. We're working in this whole region, offering service delivery to these 220,000 people living along the river there. And we're doing it all at no cost. And so we're just really thankful for our partnerships here in America, those who are sponsoring us, and then also the PNG government, who is a partner as well, and helping us accomplish the mission that we have in Papua New Guinea.
You guys have a lot going on. And first of all, thank you again, Mark, for joining us via Skype. I don't know if I introduced you via Skype earlier, but we're glad to have the technology available to us. The last time you and I talked, it was at AirVenture a couple of years ago. You had just gotten another Cessna 206 for your outreach at that time. And so you're telling me in a couple of years you've already worn out another airplane?
No, the interesting thing is we brought our first airplane over in 2010, and at the time we were just a starting organization. We purchased an older 206 that already had close to 10,000 hours on the airframe, and we actually purchased it at a discount out of Hawaii and did a refurbishment on it. But because of the corrosive environment it was at in Hawaii, a lot of corrosion started coming up in the airplane, and so we actually retired the plane this last summer. It just needed, basically, the whole body needed to be gone through. So we had that new airplane that you mentioned 2 years ago we brought over. And so now we need two airplanes where we're at. This third airplane that's coming over will actually allow us to have two airplanes operating in PNG. We're excited because, like, the one we brought over 2 years ago only has 2,500 hours on the airframe. And this new 206 that we're bringing over this year only has about 2,100 hours on it on the airframe. So we've really gone back and been able to hand pick these low time 206s and do complete overhaul modifications to them. And so we're excited to have two airplanes that we feel like we'll be able to service this area for many years to come.
So really, Mark, just to regroup, so you really, even when I spoke to you a couple of years ago at AirVenture, you mentioned that your outreach really did need two aircraft flyable at all times. And we talked a little bit about how one, would need to have certain maintenance at definite, intervals. And so this would allow you, I guess, to keep two in the air at all time while you have yet a third that might be undergoing maintenance. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, we actually, the first aircraft we retired brought back to the States, actually. And so right now we only have one operating in PNG. And with the growth of the organization, the amount of hours that we're flying every year, and one of the things that is so difficult over there, as you mentioned, maintenance and parts. Recently we had an issue with an exhaust cracking, and the plane's down for 2 weeks while we get new parts in from the States. And so it's really essential to keep our 7 days a week during daylight hours is when we fly, but to be able to respond at all of those times, we have to have two aircraft at all times, to where if one is undergoing maintenance, we have another one that we can fly, and we have enough work to have both of them going. So it's really essential that we have two airplanes on the ground in New Guinea because of the downtime. And when you have a 100-hour inspection or annual inspection, those type of things, the plane's down for maintenance. So we're excited to be bringing this new airplane. So it'll give us two in-country in New Guinea. We retired the first one that we brought over in 2010. So right now we have one in New Guinea. We're bringing a second one this summer, and we're excited to have two freshly overhauled low-time airframe Cessna 206s that we feel will give us the ability to serve this area effectively for the next for many years to come.
Cool, cool. And then just to refresh our podcast listeners here on Hangar Talk, you got started in this outreach because you originally, if I'm not mistaken, you went to school to be an A&P, and then you added on to that, your pilot certificate, because I think you told me a long time ago that you really wanted to do outreach and the missionary work, and you thought that putting those two items together would put you in a good spot. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I'm not sure how far we went down with my story before, but when I was, I'm a third generation aviator. My grandpa was a pilot in World War II. Two of my uncles flew. My cousin currently flies for the Air Force and for Delta. And so we have a long history of aviation in our family. And then my dad was a minister. So during high school, he ran a homeless mission up in Northern California. And I had a chance to help people physically, give them clothes, feed them, pray with them as well. And then going down to Mexico in high school with my church youth group and building houses for people who didn't have a house, and having those things impact my life, and just feeling this call for my life as a Christian, that I was called to go and to a remote area and share God's love in a tangible way. So for me personally, that's where my whole journey started in this area. I'd always planned on being a military or commercial pilot, but as far as going over and working in a remote area, that kind of moment, I had a moment in Mexico that really changed my life. And so, for me, it started with flying, not the maintenance side. I actually wasn't the guy that, changed my engine in my Volkswagen on the weekends in high school and was part of shop. And I really didn't care for maintenance side of things that much, to be honest, or I wasn't into mechanical stuff in high school, but I knew if I was going to work in a remote area that I had to learn how to fix my own airplane. And so that's what I did. I started flying actually at 19, started mechanic school at 20, and kind of did them at the same time. And then I also worked as a mechanic for 5 years here in the States, up in LA and San Diego, to gain the experience I knew I would need to be in the field and be in a very remote area, kind of self-sufficient. So those were all things I did in preparation. It took a long time, obviously, to get ready to serve in this kind of a remote area. And it served me very well as I was on my own for the first 5 years, doing all the flights and all the maintenance for Samaritan Aviation. And if I hadn't done all that preparation beforehand, we could have never been successful when we launched the operations in this remote area in 2010. And so that's kind of how I got started, is my background. For all of us, all of the pilots that we have now, we have four pilots on staff now, and all of those pilots are pilots and aircraft mechanics. So that's a common theme for all of our pilots.
Well, I'm thinking about that and just following up on that a little bit, Mark. For the folks who might want to enter this type of outreach, do you recommend that they would pursue both their pilot certificate and a maintenance certificate to really give them all the tools in the tool belt to do something like this?
Well, for me personally, I think having that maintenance background obviously gives you a better understanding of what what's going on in the airplane. I think there's different organizations that require different things, and so it really depends on what country you're going to. I think if you have a really good support maintenance support base, then it's not necessarily needed everywhere. And different organizations require different things. We require it in Papua New Guinea for all of our pilots, but if you're going to go with, there's a lot of different organizations out there. Some of them require it, some of them don't. So I would just recommend that people do their research. But I can tell you from experience that the more knowledge you have, the better you're going to be. So
there you go.
I highly encourage people to get their maintenance licenses if at all possible.
Well, that makes sense to me, and it's just like I was saying a minute ago, it's another tool in your tool belt, and especially if you're in a remote area and you don't know what your support's going to be. But that leads me to another question, Mark. So what is it really like to participate in this type of humanitarian outreach in a remote environment, and keeping in mind that you're a family man and you brought your family with you? I mean, what is it like to work in and out of this environment, and what's it like for your family?
Yeah, those are two very long, very good questions, very different questions in some ways, and very intertwined in others. I think for me, going to Papua New Guinea and kind of being all on my own, launching this aviation work over there, there were so many things I had to think about because I was having to manage the aviation side, which is parts and paperwork and all of that, and then I was having to manage the flight side and really figure out where we were going to land, where we could land. There hadn't been a seaplane. There was no other seaplanes in Papua New Guinea when we went in. And so trying to go into a lot of these places for the first time and try to figure out what was safe to land, where it wasn't safe to land on a river that rises and falls. It's, to give people in America some perspective, it's basically the size of the Mississippi, this river that we work on. But it also rises and falls up to 20 feet in a 3-day period based on flooding and things like that. And so every landing's different. Sometimes you've got, 100-foot trees floating down the river with roots sticking up. Other you've got crocodiles, you've got fishing nets, people in canoes. And so every time you dock the plane on the side of the river, it's different. There's no docks out there to dock up against, and so you're docking in between trees, and you're dealing with the riverbank rising and falling, and sometimes you've got a foot clearance for your wing for the river and bank, and other times you're shutting down in the middle of the river to do a river transfer because there's no way to dock on the side of the river. So it's always changing. I think for me, that was the biggest challenge, and one of the biggest challenges our pilots face is just the ever-changing work area. You're not dealing with the same runway every time. Whether it's wet or dry, you're dealing with a lot of different scenarios. There's places I used to land where it's all sand now. Sand has come down, filled it all in, and we can't even operate in there anymore. So you're constantly surveying areas of landing and checking out what's going on with the debris and things like that. But talk about remote areas, you're all of a sudden you're shipping in your fuel in 50-gallon drums. How do you get your fuel into the airplane? I mean, you don't have a fuel truck that you're calling, and you're not going over to a fuel station. Parts take a very long time, so you're trying to make sure you have the parts that wear out most commonly on the shelf. You're dealing with funding issues because we're a charity, so all of our funding comes from the states, from individuals and businesses. And so, there's a lot of things that I was dealing with and that we still deal with as an organization. Then you have your family on top of that. You bring them into this culture where, you're learning a new language. You're learning a whole new culture from the USA. When I first arrived, my youngest was 4. I had a 4, a 5, and a 7-year-old. So 2 boys and a girl. And, we've lived over there almost 8 years now. It's been an amazing, amazing adventure for us. It's difficult at times, like you said, managing family. Our family is just very a part of it. My wife is really involved. She drives the ambulance. She works with patients in the hospital that we bring in. She'll pick up medical supplies. My kids are involved now. My daughter's 16, and I got a 14 and a 12-year-old now. So they're all very involved in what we do, and it's exciting for me to have my kids involved. And I'll go on medicine deliveries and bring my kids with me, and they're there helping load the plane, being able to see the tangible impact that we're making on the people. And I think it's really given them a really great perspective of the world and to really live a life of service and to give back to others and not just be so inner focused, but really be outer focused. And I think my family taught me that as my parents ran the homeless mission. And I've really tried to teach my kids that as well. And I think they've had amazing experiences. I think there's the sacrifices too. You know, I've missed my grandpa's funeral. I've missed weddings. My wife's missed family events. And I think those are really the things probably that are the hardest for us. Of course, you miss food, you know, you miss In-N-Out Burger and, you know, the local pizza place that you like and, you know, Taco Bell, whatever it is, you know, the kids all have their favorite. But it's funny when you talk about, you know, we'll sit down as a family and every couple of months and just kind of, guys, you know, just really talk through with the kids, like, what are you missing? You know, it always goes back to food, you know, so it's just, it's a funny thing when you leave a country and then you start thinking about what do you really miss? Obviously, family, friends, food always comes up. So,
but I bet there's some cool food that you guys are having out, in New Guinea, and some unusual dishes. And I know you guys spend a lot of time with the locals and, you know, live amongst them and do what you can to help them out. So there's the flip side of that is that you're experiencing new things. The kids are experiencing new things as well. And some of the food could be a highlight over there. There might be some food there that we don't have here.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. We live on the ocean there, and we get fresh yellowfin tuna. If you ask my kids what their favorite dish in New Guinea is, I sear this yellowfin tuna. I have this special recipe and everything. It's kind of a highlight for us. You know, having smoked crocodile meat, the smoked fish at the locals, how they do it over there with their local spices. We have our P&G family that lives on an island. They're kind of our adopted family there. And so we go out to the island once a month or so and, you know, just live in the village with them. And that's another highlight, just the how they cook it with coconut milk and all of the local spices and how they do it. It's just amazing. You can't duplicate that. So, yeah, that is definitely a highlight as well.
Man, I'm staring at a cup of yogurt over here and thinking that I wished I was over in P&G with you guys and your family. Now, I know that things are tough over there. I mean, let's no bones about it. You're using float planes because there are virtually no roads, and very little electricity, and really little or no emergency medical care, and that's where you guys have really shined. And tell us a little bit about the medicine delivery that you do, and also to highlight the podcast listeners, Mark, on how many folks you have saved up to this point. I think it's a phenomenal feather in your cap that you've helped so many people.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. We also in WEWAC, where we live, the North Coast is where that one hospital is for this whole province of 600,000 people. You know, 220,000 of those people live along this long, large river. So there's also a medical storehouse where all the medical supplies from the government, from different aid organizations, and they come in and they store these medicines in a storehouse there. And one of the challenges is there's no way to get the medicines out to these remote aid posts. So if you're 3 days away from town, you have just as much of an issue getting medical supplies up to these remote areas as you do getting people from those remote areas to the one hospital. And so a big part of what we do is deliver medical supplies to over 40 different aid posts along this river. And we've delivered 130,000 pounds now of medical supplies. Another thing that we do, this last year, we've vaccinated 2,500 kids in really remote areas. And so we'll go into these areas with the plane. They haven't had a doctor in there in 15 years, some of these villages. 95% of the babies under five have zero vaccinations. And so to be able to go in there, vaccinate them, do education with them. We've also do midwifery training. So, you know, most of the babies are all born in the village as well. So working with the mothers in the village that are pregnant and those who are assisting those births to give them some information about how to have more successful deliveries. You know, infant mortality rate is some of the worst in the Asian Pacific Rim there in Papua New Guinea. And so trying to help mothers and educate them on how to successfully deliver babies or know when to call the airplane in for assistance when they see the danger signs. And so those are things that we do as well. But it's been amazing. You know, one of the stories, you know, I like to tell is, you know, right before we came in 2009, they had a cholera outbreak on the Ocetic River, and they had 3,000 people die from this disease and sickness. And so since Samaritan has arrived, we have not had anything like that. We had a cholera outbreak 1 year, and we had 90 cases in 3 days, and we were able to get in quickly with medical supplies, with nurses, and to be able to stop this outbreak. Only three people died from that. So that's the kind of impact that we can have with the seaplane, to be able to get in quickly and respond to these emergencies. We're constantly dealing with outbreaks of whooping cough, with measles, because of the lack of vaccinations. And so we were able to respond quickly to those. We celebrated our 1,000th flight last year, which was a big accomplishment for us. And so, you know, the numbers are in the thousands of the lives that we've saved and impacted. We've done over 800 life flights, which are those emergency calls that we go out with people, or it's a life and death call. But as far as the amount of people that we've impacted, yeah, I don't even know if you could put a number on that. And, you know, that's just a testament to all those people that have believed in the dream that we had and faithfully supported us all these years. Those of us who are there, we still talk about this, you know, how we're the lucky ones. You know, we actually get to be there. We actually get to see these lives saved, touch these people, pray with them, tell them about why we're there, and be the hands and feet of Jesus. And that's really our goal as an organization. And so, we're just so blessed that people support the work that we do and allow us to be there.
Well, you guys do, just to run down a little bit about what y'all do. And actually, if folks want to help you out, they can go to your website at samaviation.com. It's samaviation.com. To hear about Samaritan Aviation. You guys do life flights. You have a hospital ministry, medicine delivery, disaster relief, community health and development, and leadership and discipleship training. And I'm just reading that right off of one of your web pages. I already know that you said a thousand flights that we've had since you've been there. And that's pretty astounding. I know that you've saved people, because I think you've documented before on your website how you've rushed folks to the hospital, like you talked to us about a few minutes ago. And you know, there's a lot of life and death there. And even, Mark, you mentioned that three people died at a recent outbreak. And I know that it's quite an accomplishment that it wasn't more, but even three is too much.
Yeah. I mean, the realities are you know, it's hard to put in perspective. If you can imagine, you know, if you're living in Los Angeles and the closest hospital was Dallas, Texas, you know, that's really what the people are dealing with. And so the realities of life there are so difficult. And so when you have a breached birth, or you have a pregnancy that retained placenta, you have a poisonous snake bite. Tribal warfare is still something that happens frequently in the villages. Tuberculosis is a major issue over there. And so all of these sicknesses, and just the basic sicknesses that we all deal with here, and you're 3 days away from some help. I mean, it's a very hopeless and helpless feeling for the people. And so that's really where we're offering that access and hope to those people that don't have any other way to get help. And so we really feel blessed to be part of that service delivery to these people, because the reality is, I've been in those villages, and you realize if the plane doesn't come, you're not getting back for many, many days. And so that's just the reality of them. And you can imagine living in these villages. We'll pick up a patient, we'll bring them in, and they've never seen the ocean, never seen electricity, a car, a vehicle, those type of things. And just the getting scooped up with a seaplane. I mean, it's amazing. I still try to figure out what it would be like to experience all those things at one time. And I still haven't quite ever, I really feel like I've ever grasped it.
Yeah, that would be an unusual experience for someone who's not used to even the most basic things that we take for granted, such as electricity. Now, you talked a little bit about some of the demands on pilots and aircraft before when you were telling us about the river and the ever-changing environment for a float plane pilot. Tell me a little bit more about flight planning techniques, because, you know, our audience is, you know, a lot of pilots here, and I'm just curious about flight planning techniques and things that go into, you know, developing a mission. You know, if you have a mission that comes across on the radio or through other communication means, like, you know, can you take us through how you kind of decide where to go and when to go?
Yeah, you know, that has been an interesting process, the whole concept of flight planning, how that works, weather. You know, we don't have a weather reporting system. Some of the locations, a lot of the locations we go, we have no ability to talk to anyone to get a kind of on-the-ground weather update. So a lot of times you're really relying on local knowledge. After just being there a while, you kind of know when there's a system and when it's just the morning fog that's on the river based on an actual storm. There's a lot of that that goes in. You know, you're constantly trying to check for water levels, because on the smaller rivers, they'll drop to the point where we can't land. And so you're relying on the villagers to give you a weather update and a water update. And a lot of times they just need help. So they're going to give you what they feel like you want to hear to get the plane to leave WEWAC and come for the rescue flight. And so you're constantly trying to evaluate that. You know, the one thing that we always get are pilots that want to, hey, let me come over and work, you know, I'd like to volunteer for a month, you know, or whatever. And the reality is that most of the new pilots, you know, it's 6 to 8 months of training in PNG before we allow people to fly the airplane. And there's so much that goes into that. You've got a different culture, a different language. If you can't communicate with the people on, you know, just getting you off the bank, for example, you're between two trees, you're trying to get the plane turned before you start the engine. How does that even happen if you can't communicate with those people on the riverbank? And so there's a lot of things that pilots in America don't even think about that go into what we do. You know, we've had to come up with, you know, take pictures of our landing spots, work on you know, setting up diagrams for landing, where are the whirlpools in the river, where are the sandbars. You know, taking photos at low water, high water. There's a whole lot of stuff that goes in to what we do. And then when it's changing all the time, you're constantly having to update that. And so it's very overwhelming for the new pilots when they come over and try to just look at, you know, you're with float flying, you're already looking at a lot of different variables once you come into land. And then you add a lot more variables in Papua New Guinea. Based on the issues of debris in the water, the level of the water, like I said, fishing nets, crocodiles, all of those things that you wouldn't even think about normally have to be taken into account. You know, we have no fuel out in the river either. So once we leave WEWAC, we have to get back to WEWAC, the town that we live in. So fuel planning is a major issue to make sure you don't run low, have the contingency plans in place if there's weather. Where are you going to land if you have bad weather to wait out a storm or things like that, and making sure you always have enough fuel to get back. So that's another issue.
Absolutely. It sounds like a much more thorough pre-flight than anything we're used to over here stateside. And like you said, the conditions are constantly changing. You don't have weather that you can rely on. And I was curious, and I'm glad you answered the question about how you guys diagrammed out some of the docking spots and diagrammed out certain sections of the river to point out where would be a safe area to land your float plane and also to take off again, which is another consideration as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have some river areas that are one way in, one way out. Like you said, with the river rising and falling, there are certain areas of this river 1,000 feet wide, and there are certain spots we land at that half of the river is a sandbar that's 2 feet high part of the year, and then the other part of the year it's covered over. You can't even see the sandbar. And so, yeah, it definitely affects where you can go. There's certain areas we can't even go into once the water hits a certain level, certain lakes and things like that that come up and down during the wet and dry season. And so you have to keep all of that into consideration. And a lot of those decisions you're making from the air, because it's so remote, you're not ever getting in there on a canoe or a boat So you're relying on local people, local villagers who know the area to give you guidance. You're relying on your experience, and you're relying on a lot of low passes and flights over the water to make sure you have all the information you need to make a good decision.
Right, and that's something that I got my seaplane rating a couple of years ago, and that's something that my instructors hammered into me, which is to definitely do a low flight, you know, low pass, and assess the situation before you ever think about touching down. Hey, I know you spent a lot of time with us today on the podcast. We're almost done, and you got a lot going on. And a couple of quick questions for you, Mark, before we wrap it up. I want to remind people again that samaviation.com is how they can find your website, get in touch with you, donate to the program if they so wish. But now, thinking about how you started and a little bit about the love for aviation and the love for your mission, you know, how do you reckon other people could get involved in this type of work?
Yeah, there's a lot of different organizations doing in flying a variety of aircraft around the world. There's an organization that we're all members of. It's called the International Association of Mission Aviation. You can go to their website at imanet.org. That's imanet.org. And there'll be a list of agencies that do this work around the world. There's also a list of resources for schools that offer training, whether it's maintenance or flight as well. So I would recommend people go to that website and learn more about what the different agencies are doing, and then kind of go from there. That's a great resource for people that are trying to figure out where people are actually working, what kind of aircrafts different organizations are flying, and how they can get the training that they need and get in contact with people that can answer the questions that they have.
Gotcha. Now, I know you come stateside every so often to visit with family and donors and things like that, and maybe, you know, get the aircraft worked on or get another aircraft, as we saw when you were in AirVenture. Tell us a little bit about, you know, can folks see you guys stateside in the near future? I know a while back you did do a bunch of stops at other cities, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but people might want to say hello and shake your hand.
Yeah, you know, we will have a booth at AirVenture this summer at the seaplane base. We're also, right now, I am actually stateside. I'll be doing some events with our brand new airplane. It's actually in paint shop right now up in Seattle, and we're hoping to have it down here in San Diego, Los Angeles, Northern California, Phoenix, couple different locations in Arizona as well. So kind of on the western side, we'll be doing several events in the month of May and early June, so really excited to meet people from there. And then we'll also have a lot of staff out at AirVenture, the seaplane base, this summer with the booth as well. And so we'd love to meet people and tell stories and share more of the work that we're doing over in Papua New Guinea.
Cool deal. Now, I should have asked you this before I got the lineup of where you're going to go in your schedule, but I should have asked you this, and it's been on my mind. What is the, and forgive me for asking now, but I got to know. So what's the scariest thing that you've faced since you've been over in PNG?
Oh, man, scariest thing. That's a very good question. I think, you know, I think for me personally, the going over, being the pioneer, as would be probably a good word, and going into all of these places, we land at 65 different spots now along the river, and being the first one to go in there and trying to make those decisions from the air. I didn't have nearly as much experience, to be honest, as we require people now that come over. We've learned a lot. And I think for me, there was the pressure of knowing that these people, that all these donors had given this airplane and it had been supporting us, and they'd put that responsibility in my hand, knowing I was by myself. I had no help. If something bad happened, I was relying on other agencies to come help me out. Being in remote areas where, you know, satellite phone was your only option. And I think for me, the scariest thing was the first year of flying in New Guinea and learning on the job where to land, learning the culture, language, all of those things, and knowing that, you know, people had trusted me to make wise decisions in an area that really hadn't been landed in before. And I think that, to me, was a daily fear that I had, or it kept me, really kept me on my toes, which is good. I think, there's all of us who have flown in those kind of environments have had those moments where the trees are sure a lot closer than they, than they should be.
Yeah.
And, especially when you're going to the places for the first time and having to make those decisions from the air. And I think I've had a few of those situations, but the training we do beforehand is really valuable, and it's really kind of prepares you for those moments, and it helps you to make those wise decisions, so you don't have a lot of those over there. I think I've had some really close calls getting off of a bank of a river where you're in between two coconut trees and you're trying to get the plane pulled out, and the river's coming, the current's coming one way, the wind's blowing the other. You've got debris, you've got lots of people, when I land, there's 100 people all run up to the airplane. And so you're trying to make sure nobody's touching anything they shouldn't. And you're trying to communicate in another language on how they need to turn the plane and push you out. Anyway, there's a lot that goes on to every flight. And so there's always been those moments. But thankfully, the actual most of my scary flying, I got through before I ever went to New Guinea on that 500-hour to 600-hour range where I had some incidences, but those scary moments here in America and in Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
And I got through most of those flights, thankfully, before I ever got to New Guinea. And the flights over there have been more of a decision making. Is there a sandbar that's 6 inches below the surface? Is there a tree that's there that I'm not seeing? Is there debris that I'm going to hit? Can I get back out of this area? You've got a patient that's, dying down there. You can see him in a canoe. I'm going into a place I've never landed. Can I get safely operate this plane in and back out and save that person's life? Knowing that if you can't get in, that person is going to die. But those are the kind of pressures that you can't train for either. I would say that would be the pressure that we have, and trying to separate that life down there with the fact that if you mess it up, all the other 200,000 people along the river aren't going to have an airplane, and the organization isn't going to succeed. So I think those type of pressures you can't really ever train anyone for. We prepare our pilots the best we can for those situations. I think if you were to ask me that, those are probably the more high stress, critical decisions that we make on every flight.
Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but that is enlightening to know about that. In the back of your mind, you're correct. If one false move and 220 some odd thousand people don't really have a medical evacuation option, and they won't be able to get their medicine or get to the hospital. So that's a lot riding on your shoulders, Mark, and also the folks that work with you at SAM Aviation. So I'm going to let our podcast listeners know one more time, samaviation.com. They could catch up to you guys. They could sign up for the newsletter, and they could help donate to the cause. And I was going to ask you if there's anything I didn't ask you, and we had a great podcast interview here for Hangar Talk via Skype, and if there's anything I didn't ask you that you want to get the word out, and now be a good time to let our folks know.
One thing, funding-wise, we have a Fuel for Life program for $200. We estimate it takes $200 an hour to operate for fuel, so we have a Fuel for Life if people want to help support flights. We also are looking for monthly donations. Donor partners. We also are trying to raise the final $35,000 to ship this new airplane to PNG and get it reassembled and flying over there in the next couple months. And so that's if people want to partner with us. The other thing is just a huge thanks to all the partners, the donors, the board members of Samaritan Aviation, and to our staff. We have an amazing staff of dedicated people that are just really dedicated to serving others, dedicated to being the hands and feet of Jesus to the people of Papua New Guinea, and are giving their lives to serve those people that have no other access or hope without us being there. And so we're thankful for them. We're also thankful for all the other organizations doing amazing things around the world with airplanes and all of the things we have been able to learn from them over the years. So thankful for their example. And just the example they set in safety and piloting. And so we're just blessed to be part of a lot of different people doing amazing things around the world.
Awesome deal. And then you told us that website for the for the International Association of Missionary Aviators is IAMANet.org. So we'll get the word out for that. And we'll also remind people that Samaritan Aviation is at samaviation.com. And they could look for you on the West Coast in the next couple of months, or they could find you virtually via online, or maybe stop by the seaplane base and shake a hand and check out the new airplane, hopefully this July, right?
Yeah, so the airplane won't be at the seaplane base. We're hoping to have it in a container already on its way to PNG, but we'll have a booth. Our staff will be there. And also you can go to our Facebook page. We'll have a lot of – we update that every couple of days with updates of current flights going on, events that are happening, where we'll be with the new airplane. So you can follow us along there. We're also at Instagram, Samaritan Aviation. So there's lots of ways. And if people want to connect us or people want us to come speak at their group or event, please go to samaviation.com and contact us and let us know. We're happy to come share the stories of what we're doing over.
All right. Well, we want to say thank you very much for joining us on Hangar Talk today, and we wish you the best of luck. I hope to see you in person at the seaplane base at AirVenture in July. Thanks again for joining us on Hangar Talk.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the time.